recording. Recording time. Hey, so any thoughts that jumped out in this one, or any questions from any bits of this?
Yeah, I want to know how he can how does he put a hierarchy in there for like morality and virtue?
As far as which.
All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual.
Yeah.
Isn't there no hierarchy to sins?
No, it's true. It's a really good question. I remember the first time going through this, asking that same question and wondering how exactly that works. Because on the one hand, I've been told, like, you know, if you sin, you sin. There's no distinction between it. If you're a sinner, you're a sinner. But I'd also seen that applied inconsistently in church contexts. And also in thinking about it, I could see within my own life, there are certain sins where it was like, if persisted in, this is going to be damaging, and it's going to be damaging in this way, and so I shouldn't do this. But there's other sins where it's like, if persisted in, I will be undone as a human being. And there are certain things where I can identify those as well. I guess the best thing to say is that throughout the history of the church, a sense of like what is the center of Christian morality, we're going to get to a chapter which is called The Great Sin, and he's going to kind of go through that stuff, and he's passing on a lot of just the theology of the, you know, the history of the church. And I think in as far as that goes, I think that theology is faithful to Scripture, and I think that he is a faithful witness to that. My temptation is just to let Lewis continue to speak and have us continue to listen to him and not try to say too much in the front end, because once you've gone through all this stuff, it's kind of like, okay, I can kind of see this. If we're looking for like a biblical basis for like, hey, like some sins are like, this is a sin, and the other sins are like, this is a different category. You can look at, for instance, you can look in 1 John, where John's saying, like, if somebody is committing a sin that's not unto death, go and restore this person. I'm not talking about the sin that is unto death. There is a sin that is unto death, but now that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this other one. So if somebody does this one, then go and you know, restore such a person. So there is a sense, it's like you have both of those things. There is this egalitarian quality to sin, where it's like sin is sin, but there is also in Scripture.
Oh,
what happened?
I just poked.
Oh, okay.
That'll be
fun on the tape. there is also a sense where there is this some sort of sense of. There are kinds of sins which are unto death in a way that other ones aren't in the same way. And so I guess the best thing I can do is just let him speak. We'll follow through, and then after we've gone through those sections, we'll check in again and kind of see what we think.
I'm going to go grab a coffee real quick.
Yeah, totally. Any other kinds of things jumped out to you guys, or any spots where you had questions on stuff?
I got a little confused about the part about repressions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure what that means, and like,
yeah,
how it's different.
Yeah. So, what he's saying there, and if this starts to become obvious at some point, just say, okay, this is obvious, so stop talking.
Okay.
What he's saying there is that there's a view which was commonplace in his day, and I think is in some ways is still commonplace, where it's like, if you have a desire for anything, to go and to try to, like, you know, put like a bucket over that desire and be like, nope, not going to let that do anything. There's something that's unhealthy about that. You're oppressing something. You need to let that kind of do whatever it wants to do. And what he's saying is that, contrary to the view that would say that, what often happens is that you just end up not really knowing much of anything about the thing that you're talking about. If you do that, if you just like give license to whatever. So hello.
What's up?
What happened to your coffee?
I'm just waiting.
Oh, okay. All right. Sweet. So that's where he gets to the analogies, and so he has here you have like Wellington and Napoleon. Like Wellington is resisting Napoleon like crazy. So he's the British guy who's fighting against Napoleon. He is resisting Napoleon like crazy, and in the process of doing that, he gets to know the ins and outs of what Napoleon is like nobody else does. He has an understanding of it that nobody else does. I'm saying it, him, Napoleon's person, not an object. And he's using that in analogy, a rat catcher, somebody who's going and trying to repress rats. You get an understanding of rats. There's a knowledge of rats that comes that isn't the same if you just like let rats invade your house and kind of do whatever and don't really care one way or the other. Mm. So does that make some sense?
A little bit.
Okay.
It's kind of like how I took it, like Sherlock and Moriarty. Just because I was like, I don't really know about British and about British history. Like for Sherlock and Moriarty, like they can appreciate the other person as enemies because they appreciate like their intelligence, and they like, oh, like I don't like you, but I appreciate how you're trying to attack me because I understand. Like, does that make sense?
I feel like it's just a knowing your enemy,
yeah,
kind of thing. And the fact that, you know, say Sherlock has spent so much time combating Moriarty in different ways, he kind of knows like what defensive maneuvers he may need to implement to stop him, you know. And I think it's the same, like, you know, if you're just through the act of trying to defend yourself against this or stop it, you learn about, you know, sexuality and these things, and the more you learn about it, the better you know how to stop and just how to stop it, or, you know.
Yeah, positive or negative, whatever happens, you just know the thing. It's the same point, I think, that he's making at the end of the previous chapter, where he says, you can understand the nature of drunkenness when you are sober, not when you are drunk. Good people know about both good and evil. Bad people do not know about either. So a good person who's trying to repress evil, the repressed evil that's in them, they get to know what both good and evil are like in a way that people just don't do anything to.
Okay.
So,
yeah. I don't know if this was your question at all, but for me, it was kind of, I get how it was a little bit confusing because he talks about how people confuse the psychological term.
Yeah.
Repression.
Yeah.
And so he's like getting at what the confusion is, and he's talking about how that term actually means it's, at first, there's like that desire, and then it goes away. You don't know how it goes away, and then when it resurfaces, it comes up in like some random way. So like, say, like a sexual desire when you're little, and then it comes up like with food. And so you don't know you're dealing with that desire of sexuality, and it comes up with food instead. And but then he's like, but this is more, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he's talking about when you know you're dealing with, you're consciously dealing with that, that's not like depression. Like you're consciously like, oh, I want to sleep with that person. Like that's not repression, because it's like you know what you're dealing with. That makes any sense? No? Is that right? No?
We can come back to it.
Don't let sex rats invade your home.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No sex rats. Yeah. They're everywhere.
We should turn this into a retro Sexlandia talk. This is me. Yeah, me and Luke and Parker had a meeting here.
Like 15 or 16
years old. Yeah, you guys were really, really young, and it was going over similar territory. And Sexlandia was, I think I drew a map at one point. Yeah. One of the places was Sexlandia.
Honestly, the best analogy I've ever heard about like what it's like to live like godly, pure, security stuff.
Yeah.
But done in the funniest way possible.
I think we actually made a map on a napkin, if I remember correctly. And we're sitting right over there.
Can we recreate that?
We might be able to.
Was it on par with the Old Testament equals Zazu?
Oh my gosh.
Awesome, man. That was the best.
Yeah. You guys need to we'll point out that part from the Galatians thing where the analogy for what Paul understands the Old Testament to be like is like Zazu from The Lion King. And our relation to it is like you've kind of got Simba, you know, growing into his kingship. You know, Zazu's in charge, and then after he becomes king, it's like, yeah, Zazu's still around, he's cool, but it's like, you know, you don't take orders from Zazu in the same way. It's different. It's different. You're like, dude. You're
if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, and then you laugh because you just think about Zazu.
Yeah, and then you totally forget the actual like theological implications because you're just thinking this is ridiculous and hilarious.
You're like, you just think I just want to be on Pride.
Yeah, Rock. Like you just like your mind switches to Hakuna Matata. And anyway, so back to the topic. If you'll allow me, let me preach the gospel on this one, because I was in a position, I read this 9 years ago, and this chapter wrecked my life, because I was a mess 9 years ago. If I look at, like, who I was in relation to this kinds of stuff, I mean, really, Lewis set me up for it. He set me up bad, because literally, a page and a half before this, he goes and he solves one of the biggest problems I had in the faith, which is like, how do the choices I make actually affect like anything? How does any of this relate? And if you guys were here last week, we talked about this a lot. He says literally a page and a half before this, he says, it's not like morality is like, hey, if you do this thing, you're going to get good stuff from God. If you don't, it's like, he says, I don't think that's the best way of looking at it. I would much rather say that every time you make a choice, you are turning the central part of you that chooses into something a little different from what it was before, and taking your life as a whole with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing either into a heavenly creature, into a hellish creature, either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or one that is in a state of war and hatred with God and with its fellow creatures and with itself. And it kind of goes on from there. And I understood that. I'm like, that's what faith is. It's like that choice is me either having faith or not having faith. And it everything clicked into place, and I'm like, that it all makes sense. Like it all makes like the sense in which I am justified by faith. Like it all was like fitting together in ways that hadn't fit together before. I'm like, wow, there really is like, if I go one way or the other, it's not just like a judgment according to works kind of thing where it doesn't apply. It's like, no, this is me saying if I have faith or not. And then I got to the next page, and I was just absolutely wrecked, because my life in this area, it's like, was it the worst thing in the world? No. Was it in line with the standard that Lewis is giving here? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, part of it, I remember, I got to this line. Chastity is the most unpopular of the Christian virtues. Okay, amen, I can say that. I got to this line, and I swear to you, at least as far as I can recollect, and I remember having this feeling, I got to this line, there is no way in getting away from it. The Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. I got to that line and I just stopped. And I'm like, that is the thing that nobody, believer, unbeliever, anything, has ever had the courage to tell me before. I had never heard that before. I had heard my you know, the family background I have was like, it was complete license to like really, really anything. And it was like actively encouraged the opposite of this. But even the church background that I had is something where it wasn't really talked about much, but I remember in the Presbyterian church I was in, I remember I was in eighth grade, and yeah, this is really, oh gosh, this is the things we do. And I think we talked about some of this in the Can of Worms night. One of the things that we're good at as Protestants, we're good at doing is making things up off the top of our head, and that's what was kind of given to me as a kid in a Presbyterian church. And so, what does sexual morality look like? Well, what it means is that so you're only supposed to actually have intercourse when you're married, but there's all kinds of other fun things. And what do you do with those? Well, lucky for you, we made a list of how this is going to work. And so, you know, if you're dating, you can do this act over here. And if you're, you know, once you, like, start dating more seriously or, like, courting or make up some different words, then you can do this act over here. And then once you're, like, seriously, seriously dating, like, wow, this is really serious. We're really seriously dating now. Then you can do this thing over here. And then once you're engaged, then this thing and this thing. And I remember, like in eighth grade, like, whoa, man, this is heavy stuff. Like, is this really happening? And then once you're married, then you can actually have intercourse. But you're like, you're looking at the list of all this stuff up to there, like okie dokie. Like, you over there, do you want to start seriously dating? Like, I know I'm pointing to Luke there, but as I'm so wont to do. How do you feel about seriously dating? Because this looks like a fun option. I don't say that to absolve myself of where I was at, because I look at where I was at, and the place I was at was as a result of pride and sin and rebellion in my own heart. So much of where I was at in relation to things like this was just a matter of pride. Pride was the thing that had led me into sins like this. So I don't say this to say, like, oh man, this is all the church's fault. Like, if I had read C.S. Lewis when I was in eighth grade, if only he was my director, would things have been different? It's hard for me to say. It's definitely conceivable they wouldn't have been any different. But at least somebody would have told me what Christianity says. At least somebody would have told me the truth. And you, like in that sense, it's like, if. It's like even if the truth is something that you don't want to hear, even if it's something where it's like, this is not fun, even if you feel like the truth is something where it's going to make people leave, in the end, the truth will set us free. And if you have some substitute for the truth, which isn't actually the truth, guess what? It won't set you free. It won't do it. It's the truth that sets us free. And I had all kinds of substitutes for the truth and truth supplements in my life and things like that. And what that had done is basically turned me into a person that was tied up in a whole bunch of knots, such that I read through this chapter first. Like, I was first couple of pages, I'm like, well, there goes my life. But immediately it was like, I read this and I'm like, that's right. I read this that there's no getting away from the Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. I read that and I'm like, that is right. Because I've been living this, like, halfway abstinence crap for a long time. And I can tell you, I have zero confidence that this is right. I have zero confidence this is the way the Lord wants me to live. Because I look at what I've done in other people's lives. I look at the way I've damaged other people's lives and damaged my own life by this. Man, there's no way in heck. Now, I'm still living that way. I'm still getting by on this halfway stuff. But man, there is no way this is the way the Lord intends for things to work. It's just because none of us have the courage. Myself, prime example. None of us have the courage to actually do what we think is right in this. We're just kind of going along with whatever the rest of the culture does is, you know, it's like, I remember, like, this is confessions of, like, an eighth grader. And going through that, like, you know, into high school, I remember thinking that, like, looking around thinking all the cute girls that I know are, like, they're, like, sexually active with people, and probably the only ones left are just gonna be the ones that, like, aren't really, like, that cute, and so I better just go do that, or else I'm not gonna get any of them. I'm just gonna end up with some, like, strange looking, like, four legs or something like that. That's gonna be the only one left. It's the kind of ridiculous lies that the enemy gives you. And if you actually think about it, it's like, okay, is the Lord trustworthy? Yeah, I've experienced and trustworthy. Okay, does he like to give good gifts? Yeah, he does. Do those things come easily? No, they don't. Usually to receive any kind of good gift, it takes a long period of faithfulness to be tried and tested to the point where you can actually receive something like that. Okay, so then, will living in complete licentiousness allow me to receive a good gift from the Lord? Probably not. You're probably going to get the four-legged girl that way. Like, if you really think about it, if you want to get a four-legged girl, that's going to be the way to do it. This is, put that on the tape. These are instructions. But it's like, I just, it's just those kinds of things where I was like, I'll let the logic run its course. And I let my own pride run its course. I let all these things. So I got to the point where I'm reading through this. Every page is, I'm like, absolutely, absolutely. He goes and he's talking about, he's talking about, like, okay. Just in case you're wondering, there's a police chase. He's talking about, like, not knowing if these things are actually possible, if it's actually possible to live by the Christian standard here. And I remember thinking, like, absolutely. I look at my own life, and I don't know if it's possible. And he's talking about, like, is it possible to even, like, want this? I'm like, gosh, that's a really hard question. Because I'm looking at my own life, I'm like, God, I'm not even in a position where I'm saying, God, I really want to obey you. Like, help me to obey you. It's the being at the position of wanting to obey and just asking God for help. Like, I'm just not even there. I'm just totally doing my own thing. I'm totally letting myself be the Lord of whatever this area is. And, like, yeah, I'll check in with you occasionally, and I'll try to be, like, moderate or whatever. Whatever the heck that means.
Says before we can be cured, we must want to be cured.
Exactly, exactly. And that was this chapter put me in a position of having to face up to the fact that I didn't really, really want to be cured either. And that was really good for me. That was really, really good for me. I remember so clearly where I was when I read this chapter. I was outside in a backyard on the hammock reading this. I remember thinking, Lord, is this even possible? Looking at my family background, looking at the history that I have, the people around me, everything, just everything that's there, and thinking, like, Lord, I don't think this is possible. But I look at my own life, and I cannot explain how the heck I am here besides you being faithful. I just have no explanation for it. And eventually, I'm either going to have to say that you're not faithful, or I'm going to have to say you are faithful and be consistent in the way that I trust you. And it put me in that position. And that doesn't mean like everything was super easy afterwards. There was a long process of the Lord breaking me down and rebuilding me, which was hard and took a long time. And I was in a relationship maybe like a year or two after that for a while, which was okay with this stuff, but not fantastic. And I went for that point on, I went through like 6 years of like being single, like basically being like a hermit, being like a monk, just being like totally like no girls, like going from yeah, like what'd you say?
A hermit monk.
Yeah, Hermit. At first, I thought you said Kermit, which I thought was exciting too, because he's always been one of my heroes. Like, I went from being like,
Chase.
Yeah, it's strikingly. No, it's a good point. Very faithful to his lady. I went from being a guy in high school where the way I understood myself was like just from having like girls around, which is probably just me being extremely insecure. If you think about it. But for me, like always having girls around, something like that, to be in a position for 6 years of just not like anything, just like radio silence on that front, nothing, and the Lord rebuilding me and reworking me such that when Leanne came around, I was in a position to receive her, and I was in a position, I was in a position. If she is that most precious gift that the Lord has, I was in a position where I could be trusted with her. And that's not something where it came overnight. It would have been fun if it did, and it didn't. It came over a long period of time where me just, like, even get to the point of saying, Lord, like, I don't think I'm going to be married. And I'm like, I'm absolutely okay with that. If you had said 5 years ago, hey, man, you're not going to be married, I would be like, well, I'm going to be a Muslim then. so take that. But I honestly got to a point where the Lord built control in me over this stuff to the point where it was like, I'm just like, Lord, I don't think I'm going to be married. Like, I'm okay with that. And I rejoice in that. because you have brought me to a point that I just didn't know existed. I did not know this it existed to be like this, to have this satisfaction that I have in here. And if there is any kind of relation that I could have, just like all the relations I had before, that would take me away from you in any degree, man, you could keep it. I don't want that stuff. And if you try to give it to me, I'm gonna go be a Muslim, because I didn't say that. I wasn't making the Islam threats anymore. I'd gotten beyond that. And I got to that point, and the Lord was like, I got to the point where the Lord could trust me with something like that, and he could trust me to say, like, I really know what the truth is. I really know what the standard is. And he's not, it's not only that I know what this is, but he has built within me the self-control to be able to handle being in a relationship like this. And it's crazy. It's so cool. Like, whereas every other relationship I've had before, it has been something where this part of our relationship has been like this burden where it's like, oh, there's this guilt and shame. Even like if we're doing okay, it's like, oh, there's guilty and shame. Man, the freedom and like the lightness that Leanne and I have together is ridiculous. Like if you spend time around us, one of the things that like we've noticed about like each other is that we're really affectionate in public all the time, like just really really like silly goofy like affectionate, which I haven't really been before. And I've thought about it, and I think the reason is this: we don't have any kind of guilt when it comes to anything like sexual or like intimate or anything like that. There's no sense in which, like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this in public because there's something we're guilty about and there's something shameful that's here. And so, oh, yeah, just hold hands or something like that. We don't have any of that. It's so weird. And it's so weird coming from a position of, like, you know, feeling this guilt, feeling this heaviness, feeling this, oh, this is something that you want to cover up. Like, I don't know. I can kiss her all the time in public, just things like that. And she's like, it's like similar vice versa. And it's, like, goofy. And people were just like, you guys are weird. But it's like there's a purity that's there, which I just don't know if I ever would have thought I would have experienced. I don't know if I would have seen, like, gotten to a point of feeling like, hey, this place actually exists. So, man, I just want to preach the gospel. What Lewis is saying here is faithful. I think that what he's saying here is from the Lord. I think it's extremely hard. I think it's stuff where it tears us apart. I'm certainly in a position where it's not like, hey, and I'm not a work in progress anymore. Here's Matt. He's a finished product. Because it's like, man, I still need to, like, in every part of my mind, I'm still all over the place. I'm needing to be trained in more and more self-control and more purity and more faithfulness. Not because sex is a bad thing, but because it's such a good thing that it needs to be treated with the utmost respect as this greatest gift. So I'm still a work in progress. At the same time, it's like, I'm almost like a, I feel like kind of Martin Luther King, where it's like, I've seen the promised land. It's like, I can see this. I know this is here. And I was, for a lot of my life, was in a place where it's like, I didn't think it was a real place. I just didn't. I just got used to living in this kind of halfway zone, which was like sort of informed by Christian, like, you know, Christian ideas, but mostly sold out to the culture and mostly sold out to the enemy.
What's the real place?
The place of, I guess, being satisfied in the Lord with respect to sexuality, and the place of having, I guess you could say, of having control in that area such that it doesn't go and, you know, kind of take over the relationship. Yeah. So, man, I just want to testify. There's good stuff that the Lord has. And like wherever you happen to be at the given, like this given moment, man, pursue the Lord and trust Him, because He is good, and He takes things that look like they are not possible, and He makes them possible, and it's good. So I'll stop talking for a while.
That's awesome.
Does anybody else have questions or thoughts with this one?
I love that He kind of just destroyed the lie that, you know, where He says, like, poster after poster, film after film, you know, all these associations are being made with, for sexual indulgence that they're associated with, you know, good health, normality, youth, like,
yeah,
like, that I needed to hear that, that, you know, that association is a lie.
Yeah, totally.
That's so good.
Totally. Totally.
And the way he lays it out, like, because if you actually, you know, live this way, you're ruining your life, man. It's not healthy. It's not going to be good for you in the end. Like,
There's no situation in which just giving in to indulgence in any part of our life is going to bear good fruit in the end. And that's something where you can just look at, you can just talk to a secular person and say, look, like, what do you think about this? And, like, immediately, like, yeah, it's true. If you just give in to indulgence all the time, you're right, you can't do that. And then the question is, like, well, what do we use to go and what do we use as a framework to say which desires do we give into and which ones do we not give into? How do we regulate this? And then you get to have an interesting conversation, which is good.
And that goes into what principles you abide by.
Totally, totally. And you get to have all kinds of fun talks. So, any other questions? Any other questions from Sixlandia?
I'm glad we're going together.
I'm glad that's on the tape as well. If not, we can jump to the next one. We'll jump to the next. Do you want to press that thing? Thank you, guys. any thoughts or questions with this one? There's a couple bits where I'll bring out stuff. Hey, thanks.
I thought that last part was, I mean, of all the things that all the statements he's made are backed up pretty well. Mm-hmm. This one is just, like, no.
Hmm.
Like, I can understand that, but those two reasons that for proving it are crap.
Hmm.
Yeah.
They're so dumb.
Or can you just go over the last paragraph?
So
the last paragraph?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, it's just like a really
the last page.
Weak. Like, there's so many good reasons why.
Yeah.
That's like,
if I'm going to be frank with you,
yeah.
I don't think that the points 1 and 2 here are his strongest points in the book, which, I mean, they'd have to be pretty strong to be the strongest points in the book because there's so many strong points. I think that there's a sense in which Lewis is admittedly writing on a topic where he's like, I'm writing on this because this is a part of Christianity. I'm giving this talk to mere Christianity. And there's a sense in which I'm not really qualified for this, but I'm also the guy who signed the contract, so I'm doing this. And as far as that goes, I think he does this section really, I mean, I think he does the Christian marriage thing overall really quite well. But as a person who wasn't married at this point, I think there's just certain things where the way that he puts them isn't the best.
I think a part of that is probably because of the culture he lived in at the time, too. Where,
yeah.
Like, that is what he saw with all the different marriages, because a majority of the homes, especially back in that
yeah.
time,
yeah.
were male-dominated households. That was, like, nuclear family.
Totally. Totally.
It. So
totally.
It's like, that was the prime time for that being the ideal marriage, right?
Yeah.
And now that's kind of just been, like, all right, that's actually not mattering as much.
Yeah.
Not talked about as much.
So
it would be, like, expressed through his writing because of the culture, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that, but, like, that's not his style. Like, his style
yeah, yeah.
doesn't ever really, I mean, he pulls out stuff that's, like, long-lasting.
Yeah.
So, but
totally.
I don't, I mean, I'm not going to, like, pick him apart. I just, like, the whole time I just, like, waiting for a meaty reason, and I feel like I'm
totally. I can what I can do is I can give a couple examples of stuff where I think that there is at least we can say ways in which we can look at what he's saying and say, okay, I can see some correspondence for this, and then at that point I think we can say take it or leave it. Take the point or leave the point. It's not. I don't think that these points here are points that he himself would say, hey, this is really the center of what I'm trying to communicate. I think, if anything, he says the opposite in this. I think particularly in the Christian marriage chapter, the center of what he's trying to communicate is the pages before these things. So, point one, I won't spend time on really. Yeah, the argument's pretty straightforward. Take it or leave it. Point two, I think that there is I think that there is something which you probably had more in the time and place and culture that Lewis is in, and that in some ways the time and place and culture that we're in is a little bit unique in this way, and that the gender roles that we have in general are you could say far less defined than pretty much any other culture time and place that you're going to find, or at least in the vast majority. It's just a different, you know, we're fairly unique in that sense. In general, I think you can say that, I think in general you can say that, the role of the man in, as far as, if you, like, you can take this analogy, you can say, maybe I'll say even 47 times again, even. one way of looking at it is that you can say that, if you were to look at, like, a governmental example, you can say that a man's role for a lot of this ends up being, like, foreign policy kinds of things. So the relations between different households, between different things like that. The woman's role ends up being, like, domestic policy. You know, studying the rules in the house, within the household, as far as, you know, what goes in here, what doesn't go. Or whatever, you can fill in any number of analogies. Now, again, take that or leave it too, because we're not really dealing with a ton of like you know, huge biblical stuff there, and it's not the main point that he's trying to convey. I think that what he's trying to say is that there are, if you look throughout history, and you can say this within the history of the church as well, it seems as though that men have gifts that are more suited towards that, and women have gifts which are more suited towards that, and that's just the way that things normally go. I have a friend whose wife talks to me about the I think of this section because it's always kind of a section I don't really know what to do with, and the only time I've really come across something where I'm like, oh, this reminds me of this thing which I've just kind of passed by, is she'll talk often about the women's ministry at the church that they're at, and how women's ministry is so terrible and why it's like so bad, and tell me all the reasons why. And she always says this, and I feel sheepish repeating it because I don't really know what to do with this, and so I just kind of get quiet and don't really say anything. But she says the problem with women's ministry is they need to have a man running it, which is one of those things where it's like, if I was to say something like that, I'd be prepared for a guillotine to come flying my way and like for my head to go rolling down into the parking lot. And, like, I would, like, if I was sitting, I would kind of probably feel like, yeah, that would probably be right for something like that to happen. Like, bring the guillotine. I think the point that she's trying to make, and she's explained to me a few times what she means by it, is that I've even trying to explain the things that she says, I feel like there's, like, I'm going to, like, cut my own head off at some point here. So if I misspeak at some point, just know I'm like guillotining myself as I think about this. the point that she's trying to make is just that the particular gifts that she sees from women ministering within the church, the things that she's like, yeah, this is a particular gift where women are able to do this really, really awesome. She doesn't find this with somebody having that this is the direction that we're going. So if you use another analogy, which again could be completely guillotine worthy, and so if it is, like, guillotine the analogy, you could say, like, take a ship analogy like Lewis has elsewhere, where you've got one side of things is, where is the ship going? Charting the course. Okay, here's where we're going. The other part is the policy within the ship. This is what we're going to do on the ship. This is how things are going to work within the ship. From her perspective, everybody in the women's ministry thing is like, this is how things are going to operate within the ship. We're going to have things like this, and this is we're going to act this way and do this thing. And there's no sense of, like, where is the ship actually going? Where are we actually going towards? And so because of that, like, nothing actually really ends up happening within it. And so that's the basis of her, the thing that she's said a few times, which is like, whatever. I'm sure if this was conversely, if this was like a men's minister conversation, you could probably have the converse kind of comments made about if you have all men just doing something, the weaknesses that can come up, you know, via that route. But as I said, if none of that is helpful whatsoever, just guillotine it and guillotine me if you want, because
I don't want to guillotine you.
Well, all right, whatever. there's some really interesting bits in this chapter. Any other ones that come out to you, for sure go. This is a fun little bit of trivia, I guess. He has the point here where he's talking about he's talking about, you know, what should we do? Should the Christian marriage be the state's view of marriage? And he's like okay, no, there should be two standards. Interesting thing. He actually gets taken to task by some Christian sources for this. And one of the people who does this is actually J.R.R. Tolkien, the guy who writes The Lord of the Rings, and he was instrumental, like, the instrumental person in bringing Lewis to Christ.
He used to hang out.
Yeah. And Tolkien, and Tolkien's not alone, this is one of the things where Lewis people challenge what he's saying on this. Tolkien actually writes this longish letter to Lewis, which he never actually sends, and I think it's just because he feels really strongly about it. He feels really strongly like what you're doing isn't, like, you've oversimplified this thing. You're not actually, he thinks he's missed something. But you can actually find the letter online. It's really, really interesting. So if you guys are interested, I can send it over to you. It's just another perspective on it. But just so you know, this is an area where
I love Tolkien.
Yeah, totally. There's for the vast majority of stuff in this book, it's like I'm just like what Lewis is saying here is just he's just a faithful witness. And there's occasional spots where it's like there's a couple positions on this thing, and you can kind of go this way or you can go this way, and there's not like a hard and fast kind of deal. And so this is a good one to look at both views and kind of debate that out, I think.
I really dug what he said about the marriage deal, like, being separate. Like,
totally.
Well, if they're married as Christians, then, like, there should be higher standards of, like, what they're looking for, what
yeah.
God
Isn't
wants for like their, like, commitment and stuff.
So a lot of people say, well, we got married before Christ. You're like, oh, wow, all right.
Yeah. There is... So the issue here isn't really marriage. There's underlying church-state issues. How do we understand the relation of the church to the state? That's the underlying issue that's there. And that's really the thing that you have to get at. And if you want a fun one for that, like the one I recommended to Judah, Defending Constantine, is a really good place to start. Because then you're actually getting into how does this actually work when the church goes from being this persecuted minority to actually, those in power saying, we think what you guys are saying is true. So what do we do now? What should that mean? What do you do when you convert the emperor? When your evangelism works? What are you meant to do as a Christian? It's like not easy stuff. And I think the best, or at least best way I can think of to explore that, is to look at what actually happened. And start with that and go off that. So Defending Constantine is a really, really good resource for that. But it's a broader conversation, and that's the conversation to have, not just like, you know, civil marriage or non-civil marriage, because there's deeper theological issues that are there.
I think kind of on like the same note that was happening, because I know, like, when we were talking about like the Defending Constantine thing, and like when we were saying like they were saying like they should be like pushing people to like convert to Christianity like when you're the person like in power, like, you know, do you remember that conversation we had?
Yeah totally.
But then here it sounds like he's saying like we shouldn't do that. So because he said we'd be angry if like the Mohammedans were like
totally
telling us not to drink wine.
Totally.
Like, how does...
No, and I think it's something where in this area, Lewis at this time is kind of giving like more of a hands-off kind of thing. Like, separate the church over here and the state over here, and those things operate fairly independently. Some of the grounds, I haven't gone through all of Tolkien's responses, so I can't go and give that to you guys verbatim. I can pass it on to you. I think some of the ways that I would, if I was trying to articulate a different position on this, one of the things that I would say is that the church-state framework that he's conceiving is itself reductionistic, because that framework is itself a Christian framework. It's not just like you have this neutral thing called the state with its neutral set of values. The values that the state works with have to be informed by something. If you say, okay, let's just go with whatever reason says. Well, if you go with societies that have said that, you're gonna get a wide variety of different things. There's gonna be correspondence to be sure, but how, like, what do you do on tough cases? What's the state's role with respect to morality? This is a really interesting example. Britain just passed a law where it's basically outlawing pornography and saying that there's now in Britain on the internet, there's going to be this automatic thing where it shuts down pornography, and if you want to have access to pornography, you have to, like, call some phone line and, like, opt in so that your internet connection is enabled for pornography, which is one of those things where it's like, that's going to make things real. Like, that changes the game in a lot of ways. That is the state going, and it's taking a moral issue, pornography, and taking a stand on it and say, we're not just going to let anybody have access to this stuff. You have to, like, if you want to have access to this, you can call us and we'll give you permission for it. Like, we'll enable you. But otherwise, our default position is no, which is going to be like, those are going to be really awkward conversations.
Yeah,
seriously.
Oh.
Seriously.
Oh.
Yeah. 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 Which is okay. So at that point, like, you're getting into an interesting issue there, because it's like, this isn't just like, you see that morality.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, thanks.
Wow, look at that.
Oh.
Selling drugs.
To my coworkers.
Yeah. Awesome. You can see it's like, wait a second, that's a moral issue. You guys are legislating morality. Well, yeah, the state does that. We say, oh yeah, you can't legislate morality, but you can't really get away from it either. And so I think that what Lewis is saying here with respect to church-state relations, I think is maybe a bit simplistic in some ways. I don't think that the church and the state are meant to ever be equated with one another. I think that the times they've done that, it's been disastrous, because the church is meant to have witness against the state. The church is never meant to be, hey, we're the ones with political power, look at us, because the church is always meant to go and to stand up in some ways, provide some sort of witness to whatever the political power is, so you can't equate them. But at the same time, I think that in the end, I think that a strong kind of like church over here, state over here sort of thing is reductionistic. I don't think it holds, and we've had these conversations also. I can't remember if you've been here for the sessions we've had those. But if you look, for instance, in the States, the church-state relationship that we have, it works on one level until we actually look at our Constitution and we realize the values that the state is saying, hey, these are our values, they're themselves Christian values, and distinctly so. They're not like this separate realm of just like kind of like morality that hangs off in the air. It's amorphous somewhere that you can just sort of pull off of. No, it has like legs that are on a certain place called Christianilandia. It's like that's where that's rooted. So anyway, I'll send that thing to you guys. Have a look at it. It's really interesting.
Yeah. It's cool.
Any other bits jump out from this one for you guys? I had a million bits that jumped out for me, but
it's too many.
This is, there's a spot here, it reminds me of it. He says, people get from books the idea that if you have married the right person, you may go on expect to go on being in love forever. As a result, when they find they are not, they think this proves that they have made a mistake and are entitled to change, not realizing that when they've changed the glamour role, presently go out of the love of one or the old one. We have a husband and wife professor combination at Regent, Paul and Sarah Williams, who are like these awesome, awesome folks. And they talk about relationships and different things like that sometimes. And one of the things that, I mean, they're totally in different fields. They're totally like they both went to Oxford, like huge like academics and stuff. But they're like just very, very relatable. And one of the things that Sarah Williams, she has this great line, she says, everybody marries the wrong person. There's no such thing as marrying, I married the right person. No, everybody is the wrong person in one way or another. And everybody marries the wrong person. It just happens.
Not fully developed?
Because we're all the wrong, like, we're all the wrong people. There's no such thing as, like, hey, like, I messed up on that. I'm just going to go and find a different person. We're all the wrong person. I think that's a helpful framework to have because it is, we just have such, I don't know.
Is she talking about the sense that everyone changes and so you're constantly developing and it's your choice to develop or not? Like, you can be in a relationship and you can improve as a person, but that's your choice? Like, is that what you're talking about? Like, we're not Jesus?
Yeah, yeah. Not like Christ leads everyone into error, so just accept that you are in a huge error and that Christ is not leading you, because she wouldn't say anything like that. I think she's more speaking against the idea that if we find the right person, then everything will be okay. And so defining and having that be the category for like the way we measure, it's like, hey, is this good or not?
I don't want to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
This is not what C.S. Lewis talked about at all, but like this finding, like, what does that even mean? Like, how do you find something? How do you find the right person, or if it's the wrong person? Like, in general.
I think what they're saying is, like, everybody is the wrong person, and what that means, like, is, like, when you're actually in a relationship with someone, you have to work past whatever the faults are that are just going to be naturally there, because everybody does have them. And so, like, I learned this from Jeff Reed. I think it was really helpful.
I understood that.
What he said with, like, the marriage deal was, like, with his wife, he was like, look, once I committed to my wife and I was married, that's when it was the rest of my life. It wasn't, like, previously, or it wasn't, like, you know what I mean? So it's, like, because a lot of people have the issues with mixing up, like, their commitment levels, if that makes sense. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I don't think so at all.
No, I think... No, it totally was not what I was saying, but... sorry.
But I still like you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
No, I like what you said, but that's not what I was saying. I understand, like, that whole, like, this is separate from that. This is the language that everyone uses, saying finding. I need to find. I found. I blah, blah. Like, what is that? I think it just is the basis of perception of a lot of marriage, whatever it is. Like, I don't know, that's part of it, I think. So, I wish Lewis was alive, I would ask him.
Anybody have the answer?
I've never actually thought about it before. It's a good question.
I made the book into a heart shape.
Great.
Is that useful? Yeah.
Maybe if we all
are you
it.
Curious
maybe
as
we
all, to like maybe we could all be referring like, to by that term or like what that yeah. action actually looks around? Like or like
there you go. Yeah, like both. I think it's just really interesting. Not like I need an answer, it's like a
rhetorical.
I don't know. It's not really rhetorical. It's like, it's because we all mean something by it, right?
I think it could just refer to the dating process in general, and I guess things prior to that. And that's kind of based off of like a lot of, I guess, your principles and what kind of person you, I don't know, I feel like you already know this.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I wish I could give you a good answer.
Yeah, totally. I don't think, I mean, I won't belabor the point or anything, but I just, like, I have nothing formulaic whatsoever to say in this area.
Yeah.
Because the way I got in a relationship initially with Leanne was that I thought she liked me, and I didn't know if I was really, like, into it or not or whatever, and I'm like, I'm just gonna, like, run away from this thing. And so I committed it in my heart. I'm like, look, I'm just not gonna, like, I'm just gonna go back to being a nerd. And so I did that, and I'm like, sweet Lord, I'm doing this. Like, I'm not gonna open this door, I'm not gonna get into this thing. I'm just gonna focus on what you wanna focus on, because I don't want me to get hurt, I don't want to hurt you. I don't really know about us.
One night while Matt was seriously inebriated.
Yeah. And then I got real drunk, and then I just staged the game. No, seriously,
Seriously,
no, I got really drunk. I made that decision in my heart, and then it took about 4 days after that where I'm like, okay, I made a decision day one. Next 4 days, like, I don't really sleep at all, and I don't know why I couldn't sleep. But I just could not sleep. And I end up like staying up and just like laying there. Literally, just laying there, not doing anything. And I'm not a person that has sleeping problems. Like, I don't ever really have sleeping problems. I just did not sleep. And sometimes not all the time I'd be thinking about Leanne, but most of the time I'd end up thinking about Leanne. I'm like, this is weird, because I don't really think I have I've kind of like looked over my math here, and I don't really, as far as I can tell, I don't think this would work out or whatever, so I'm not even gonna, like, you know, it makes sense, I'm not gonna do this. I could not sleep, so I would just stay up praying, like, Lord, why can't I sleep? I would like to go to sleep. If you would let me sleep someday, that'd be really great. Like, and so after 4 days, this 4 or 5 days, I got to a point where I'm just like, Lord, maybe I should think about this, because if I don't, I might turn into a zombie. And so I started, like, reassessing what I said, or what kind of the decision that I had made in my heart, saying, Lord, is this really what you have for me? And I just started having people pray for me, saying, hey, could you pray for me this? Because, like, I had made a decision in my heart to kind of go this way, and, like, something weird has happened, and I don't get it, and I don't know what's going on, and I don't understand it. But can you pray to the Lord for me and pray that he'll make this clear? Because I don't get it. And what happened after that was a long process of still not getting it.
Yeah.
Like, that's just how it was. I can testify that my orchestration of my relationship with Leanne is, like, it's not even, like, zero. It's in the negative regions. Because, like, I tried to unorchestrate the relationship. Like, I, like, actively tried to unorchestrate it. And that did not work, which is probably a testimony to the Lord.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
So, like, in that situation, is that what you're questioning? Like, did Matt find her? Can you say, like, I found her? Like, is that kind of what you're, like, does that make sense?
Yeah, does that make sense?
Because, like, I think a lot of people are like, hey, I'm in a relationship, I found them. But, like, you didn't really find anything. Or, like, that word, like, almost like what C.S. Lewis was, like, talking about in the beginning, that, like, words lose their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you're talking about, like, they're a Christian, like, that word actually doesn't have their meaning, because it's describing if they're a good person or not. Kind of in that similar way.
Yeah.
Like, asking.
Yeah.
You really, like,
dude, we're,
like, has that word lost its meaning?
We're way over time. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm a big idiot. Sorry. We should do something else. Does somebody want to pray?
We should do something else.
Yeah, like, we're
just, I'm tired of this.
Not that we need to go to something else. I just realized I'd kept you guys over a half hour afterwards.
Dude,
this is chilling. Yeah, no, totally. Well, we can hang out more, but maybe let's pray and stop this officially, so people can go if they want. Does anybody feel pray-y? You want to do it?
Great.
Awesome. That's great.
God, thank you so much for just Matt and his ability to teach and just humbly kind of, like, lay out
his readings of C.S. Lewis and just kind of like all the rad stuff that you you've given to us through these times, and just the principles and the ability to understand things that are hard to grasp sometimes, and now we get to understand your character more fully. So just thank you so much for that, God. And I ask that like all these principles would be used in all of our lives, and that this time would seriously continue to change us.
Thanks, buddy.
Right there.